Welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger for April 29, Monday, 2024. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger, and here is our first story from the Globe Gazette. Headline, Hinson trip to Ukraine swayed her vote on aid. And it is written by Tom Barton, and the dateline is Cedar Rapids. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, Republican of Iowa, says Americans' interest in arming Ukraine are more clear to her now, following a visit to the country earlier this month. President Joe Biden on Wednesday signed into law a $95 billion foreign aid measure that includes nearly $61 billion in aid to Ukraine, $26 billion for Israel, and $8 billion for the Indo-Pacific. Biden immediately approved sending $1 billion in military assistance to Ukraine as a first installment, rushing badly needed weaponry and military equipment to aid its fight against Russia's invasion of the Eastern European ally. The package includes air defense capabilities, artillery rounds, armored vehicles, and other weapons to help Ukrainian forces recover after months of setbacks. Meanwhile, Ukraine, for the first time, has begun using long-range ballistic missiles provided secretly by the United States. The aid to Ukraine comes after months of delays and personal lobbying and pleading by Biden and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and tense negotiations with House Republicans. Conservatives in Congress have opposed sending additional assistance to Ukraine, with the war appearing to have no end in sight. Hinson voted for the foreign aid bill and has supported as well as opposed previous funding packages providing military assistance to Ukraine. She and U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican of Iowa, met with Zelensky earlier this month in Ukraine's northern Chernihiv Oblast. Zelensky posted an X, formerly Twitter, that he briefed the bipartisan delegation of U.S. Congress members on the situation on the B field, our Army's urgent needs, and the scale of the illegal deportation of Ukrainian children to Russia, he said. And he also emphasized the vital need for Congress to approve another military aid package to Ukraine. Hinson said the fact-finding mission helps solidify her support to get foreign aid package across the finish line. She continued, so I thought it was really important, and my constituents thought that it was really important, that we know and have proper oversight on the funding and military equipment to ensure it reaches the intended recipients in Ukraine, Hinson said in Cedar Rapids on Thursday morning. The Marion Republican also met with the U.S. Brigadier General in charge of the 10,000 U.S. troops stationed in southern Poland. And hearing directly from him about, hey, we know exactly where this equipment is going, the U.S. military is working directly with Ukrainians to not only get that equipment where it needs to go, but to maintain it and help us sustain that effort, that was really important to see it in person and hear directly from them, Hinson said. She said the delegation also met with anti-corruption officials in Ukraine to discuss increasing accountability. They also discussed the importance of maintaining the port in Odessa, Ukraine, due to its strategic importance for global food supply. So I think that Americans' interests in Ukraine are more clear to me after that visit, and not just in Ukraine, but in Poland, and where we are also able to visit, Hinson said. Former President Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, has complained European allies have not done enough for Ukraine. While stopping short of endorsing the funding package, Trump last week said Ukraine's survival is important to the United States, a shift in tone just days before the Republican-led U.S. House of Representatives passed the aid package. I agree with this sentiment, Hinson said. We need to make sure our allies in Europe are stepping up, and I think we're seeing increased incidence of that. And frankly, I've been saying this for months. We cannot let Russian President Vladimir Putin win. We need to stand with our freedom-loving allies around the world. And I think we sent a pretty clear message that the United States does, she said. Biden on Wednesday also signed a measure that will force social media platform TikTok's Chinese parent company to divest from its U.S. operations or face a nationwide ban. TikTok's critics, which include Hinson, have argued the app could put U.S. customer data at risk because Chinese law requires China's companies to share information with the government. TikTok has maintained that it operates independently and protects U.S. data. The law gives parent company ByteDance 9 months or potentially up to a year to find an approved buyer for TikTok. If it fails to do so, TikTok will be banned from U.S. app stores. Asked if she was worried that the move would could prompt other countries to force U.S. firms to sell their local operations or to transfer them to a foreign company, Hinson cited national security concerns because of TikTok's Chinese ties. If it sets a precedent that we're not going to allow our adversaries, if it sets a precedent that we're not going to allow our adversaries to have control over Americans' data, then I'm glad that precedent is being set, she said. We have to do what we need to do to eliminate national security threats with adversaries like the CCP, Chinese Communist Party, who have shown that they're willing to weaponize those platforms and hack Americans' data in our infrastructure networks and in our water, transportation, energy sectors. So they have proven that they are not a good actor. So I think this is the right move and the right tone to set. I don't know what their reaction will be on the other side, but we always have to do the right thing to protect American security. TikTok is expected to argue that a forced sale could violate its users' free speech rights because a new owner could change the app's content policies and reshape what users are able to freely share on the platform. TikTok content creators, including businesses, have said they are worried about the platform's future that has enabled them to grow their businesses and build communities. Hinson said the goal is not a ban, but a forced divestiture by ByteDance because of concerns that top Chinese government officials have access to American users' data and could use such access to manipulate TikTok's algorithm to sow divisiveness and discord, poison U.S. public opinion, and suppress content critical of Beijing. This is not about eliminating your platform or your ability to get your message out, she said. This is about making sure that Americans' data is protected, and I think we can have both, and I think that this bill does that balance. And I think within a year you'll see there will be an American buyer who makes sure that our small business owners and content creators and that kids can still continue to watch the content that they want. Right below that article on the front page is this one. Pat Grassley, State Had to Act on Immigration is the headline, written by Caleb McCullough of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau, and the dateline is Johnston. State House Republicans understand the difficulties and uncertainties related to a new state law on immigration, but felt compelled to take action because of inaction by the federal government, House Speaker Pat Grassley said Friday. Grassley discussed the new law and other topics Friday while recording this weekend's episode of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. Republicans during the recently concluded 2024 legislative session passed a law that enables Iowa law enforcement officials to arrest and deport migrants who cross into Iowa illegally. Some Iowa law enforcement officers have warned the new law will be creating mistrust between law and enforcement in the state's immigrant communities and have said the law creates logistical questions like how state and local officers will deport migrants and who would pay for that. Grassley said he understands those concerns, but said Republicans wanted to take action on what is a top issue for Iowans. Grassley noted Republicans approved $2 million in new funding to the Iowa Department of Public Safety to help with enforcement of the new law. Grassley also noted that a similar law passed in Texas has been challenged in the courts. "We understand the difficulties that come from that bill and some of the uncertainties that it creates," Grassley said. We did put some money in to support law enforcement to try to help implement it. But at the end of the day, some of it is, and I've shared this with some of the members of our federal delegation, that if the federal government, regardless if you're Republican or Democrat, whoever is in charge, if they do not address the number one issue that we're hearing about, states are going to be left in a position where we have to do something. Telling our constituents that the number one issue we're hearing about is something we can't do anything about or even attempt to do anything, I think really is not the right decision for the states to make. We have to do everything we can to try to implement policies that we think will address the number one concern that we're hearing, Grassley said. When asked if states should pay for deporting migrants, Grassley criticized federal immigration enforcement agencies for a lack of communication with states. "Part of the problem that we have with the whole immigration right now is the fact that we have no guidance from the federal government," Grassley said. "Some of the conversations we've had with law enforcement convey when they may be pull over someone or arrest someone. They can't even get any feedback from the federal government about what is the status of this individual. We have no cooperation from the federal agencies like ICE, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and others that should be giving some guidance to the states," he said. Given those concerns, Grassley was asked, "Did congressional Republicans err in killing immigration policy legislation that was negotiated for 4 months by Republican and Democratic leaders to ensure passage through the U.S. House and Senate?" And Grassley demurred, saying he is not familiar with the failed bill's details. "I think I'm going to leave that question to the other Grassley," Pat Grassley said, referring to his grandfather, Iowa U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley. "Here's what I can tell you. I have shared with the other Grassley why we did what we did from the state perspective, that this is something that states are going to have to act," Pat Grassley said. "As far as the ins and outs of the federal immigration bill, I have enough bills on my plate to try to remember to come talk to you guys, reporters, about as far as the ins and outs of every piece of legislation. Iowa Press episodes can be viewed online at iowapbs.org. Story 3 on the front page. Despite 2020, Iowa election recount laws stay the same, is the headline. Again, written by Aaron Murphy, Gazette Des Moines Bureau, Dateline Des Moines. "Iowa's recount procedures will be the same for this fall's election as they were 4 years ago, when inconsistencies across counties caused consternation in the recount of an historically close congressional election. The legislature concluded its regular work April 20 without addressing most of the concerns raised by local and state election officials regarding the patchwork of laws and rules for how counties should conduct election recounts. We're 4 years down the road, and an obvious situation which called for corrective legislation has not happened for 4 years later," said Linn County Auditor Joel Miller, whose county was part of the 2020 recount of the former 2nd Congressional District campaign between Republican Marionette Miller Meeks and Democrat Rita Hart. "And we're facing another election where we may again have close races. And I can imagine a new close race happening between Miller Meeks and 2024 Democratic candidate Christina Bohannon," Miller said. "So, you know, history may repeat itself." In the 2020 elections, Miller Meeks edged Hart by just 6 votes out of nearly 200,000 cast. During the recount of those results, because Iowa provides broad discretion to recount boards to decide the mechanics, some counties completed hand recounts, some completed machine recounts, and some, including Johnson and Scott counties, did a hybrid version. Ever since, county auditors, the local elected officials who oversee elections, along with their state association, the Iowa State Association of County Auditors, and Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate, the top statewide election officials have implored state lawmakers to provide more consistency in county recount procedures. At least two bills were introduced over the past 2 years to address county recount procedures, but neither advanced. Obviously, I would like to have seen it pass, said Pate, who introduced the legislation from his office. That bill was never given an initial legislative hearing in the Iowa legislature. I thought we worked it very effectively. We've worked with county auditors and we've worked with legislators in several state cycles now on trying to identify the practices, he said. Among the proposals in Pate's bill, House Study Bill 627, county recount boards would have been different sizes based on the population or number of votes cast in a county. Currently, all recount boards have 3 members. And when a candidate requests a recount in a county, all precincts within that county would be required to conduct a recount. A recount board would be required to start its work no later than 6 days after the canvass. A different bill dealing with county recount procedures, which took a similar approach as Pate's bill, was introduced in 2023 by Representative Bobby Kaufman, a Republican from Wilton. That bill was approved by a House subcommittee and committee, but was not taken further. Among the proposals in that 2023 Kaufman bill, House File 356, were the following. The deadline to request a recount would have been moved from the third day following the canvass of election result to 2 days after the canvass, and a recount board would have been required to convene within 6 days of the canvass. Recounts would have been required to be completed within 17 days of the canvass for a presidential election, within 21 days of the election for Congress or state office, and within 13 days of any other election. A recount request would have been required to include all precincts in a county. The request would have been required to state whether a machine recount is requested or a machine-in-hand recount, and any request for a hand recount would have been required to include all counties in a district. And more populous counties would be able to add more workers to its recount board. Under current law, each county, regardless of its size, can have only 3 recount board members. Well, Becky Bissell, the Adams County Auditor and President of the Iowa State Association of County Auditors, said the group was supportive of Pate's bill. Officially, the organization did not register as a lobbyist on Pate's 2024 bill and was registered as undecided on Kaufman's 2023 bill. Without any updates to state recount laws, elections officials said they are concerned that this fall's election could produce another close decision and another multi-county recount that could once again lay bare those inconsistencies. We were definitely disappointed because in the end, we just want to see more consistency and a little bit better clarification on the rules so that we don't have any discrepancies and people don't have any doubt in the process, Bissell said. Pate and county auditors said they are not sure why both bills failed to advance. The Gazette was unable Thursday to contact the state lawmakers who lead the committees that deal with state election laws. Kaufman, in 2023, said his bill was an attempt to accomplish the goals set out by the local election officials. The one thing I heard from Democrats, Republicans, and auditors, people that sit on recount boards, is we need uniformity, Kaufman said last year. We need predictability. We need to know exactly what we're all getting into. No ambiguity, no gray area. That was my motivation, was to create a uniform set of rules that everybody knows what the game is. Everybody knows how to play it. Everybody knows what the rules are, he said. Well, state lawmakers did pass legislation that requires a county recount board to include in its report to the state a full accounting of the recounted ballots and, if necessary, requires the board to meet a second time if an initial recount was deemed incorrect. That provision addresses a recent recount in Scott County where a state legislative race was decided by 11 votes, but only after multiple recounts showed varying numbers of absentee ballots recounted. Pate said his top priority was addressed in House File 2466, which passed the legislature and is awaiting Governor Kim Reynolds' signature to become law. That was very important. That was the biggest piece I wanted to get done, Pate said. Bottom line means the recounts have got to balance, has to be accurate. You don't get to just go home. We wanted to make sure that one was cleared up really quickly, because that goes against the grain of everything I stand for. When we total up at the end of an election, the numbers need to balance so people have the assurances that their vote was counted, he said. Terry Tompkins, the Scott County auditor, said her office will continue to work with the county attorney and Pate's office to follow state law in any future recounts. Iowa's 2024 primary election is June 4, and the general election is November 5. Turning now to some national headlines. This is an Associated Press article. Israel protests continue on campuses around the country. Protests continued to roil college campuses nationwide as administrators, with graduation ceremonies next month, faced demands as schools cut financial ties to Israel against the backdrop of the Israel-Hamas war. Many campuses were largely quiet by early afternoon Sunday, but about 275 people were arrested on Saturday at campuses including Indiana University at Bloomington, Arizona State University, and Washington University in St. Louis. Those have pushed the number of arrests nationwide to nearly 900 since New York police removed a pro-Palestinian protest encampment at Columbia University and arrested more than 100 demonstrators on April 18. Since then, students have dug in at dozens of pro-Palestinian encampments around the country. White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby said President Joe Biden knows that there are very strong feelings, but would leave managing the protest to local authorities. People should have the ability to air their views and to share their perspectives publicly, but it has to be peaceful, Kirby said on ABC's This Week. In an interview that aired Sunday, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell called it a dangerous situation and placed the responsibility with college administrators. There's also anti-Semitism, which is completely unacceptable. I've been shocked to see that in this country, he said on NBC's Meet the Press. Here's a few short, brief national stories. Blinken plans return to Middle East this week. It's Secretary of State Antony Blinken is returning to the Middle East on his seventh diplomatic mission to the region since the Israeli-Hamas war in Gaza began more than 6 months ago, the State Department said Saturday. Blinken will travel to Saudi Arabia on Monday, just 2 days since arriving back in Washington after a trip to China. Blinken will attend a World Economic Forum conference and meet with Arab foreign ministers in Riyadh, the Saudi capital. An Israeli foreign ministry official said Blinken will visit Israel on Tuesday, stop not mentioned in the State Department's announcement about Blinken's itinerary. And in San Juan, Puerto Rico, President Joe Biden won the Democratic presidential primary Sunday in the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico was authorized to open only a dozen voting centers this year, compared with more than 100 in previous years, given recent austerity measures imposed by a federal control board that oversees the island's finances. On Sunday, Puerto Rico's Democrats also chose 36 of 65 delegates they hope to send to the National Democratic Convention that will be held in Chicago in late August. Although residents of Puerto Rico are U.S. citizens, they are not allowed to vote in presidential elections. London. King Charles III will resume some public duties this week following a three-month break to focus on his treatment and recuperation after he was diagnosed with an undisclosed type of cancer, Buckingham Palace said Sunday. And a teenage gunman wounded 10 people when he opened fire early Sunday after fighting broke out during a private event at a Florida party venue, authorities said. A security guard tackled and disarmed the shooter immediately, and none of the victims suffered life-threatening injuries, the sheriff's office said in a statement. Philadelphia. Authorities said Friday that the 15 and 16-year-olds arrested after an April 10 shooting at Clara Muhammad Square in Philadelphia will be charged as adults and will face aggravated assault, conspiracy, simple assault, and reckless endangering charges in addition to the firearms counts they faced earlier. Alaska. A helicopter crew on Saturday recovered the body of Robbie Mikas, 52, of Keene Valley, New York, a climber who died after falling about 1,000 feet while on a steep technical route in Alaska's Denali National Park and Reserve Park, officials said. Didn't see any obituaries on today's paper, so I'm jumping over here now to sports. And it's the WNBA. Clark's focus back on basketball as Fever Camp opens, written by Michael Marot, M-A-R-O-T. Indianapolis. Caitlin Clark got back to the basics Sunday, working out on a basketball court. Here, as the newest member of the Indiana Fever, she's learning how she'll fit into this new offensive system, building chemistry with her new teammates and learning the nuances of what it means to be the WNBA's highest-profile rookie. Sure, Clark anticipates some bumps this season. She wouldn't expect anything less, but giving the sport she loves her full attention is really all Clark ever wanted. I think that's what I was most excited for, getting all that other stuff out of the way, the former Iowa star said as Indiana's training camp opened. The draft was amazing. New York City was amazing. Los Angeles was amazing. But I was excited to get here and get back to playing basketball, you know, doing my job, she said. Over the past two seasons, these WNBA rookies have created the kind of buzz around women's basketball most fans only dreamed about, and Clark is indisputably at the head of the class. Ticket sales increased at every venue she appeared, and when Clark's games were televised, ratings spiked. Her chase of the Division I career scoring record captivated basketball fans across America, and she even appeared on Saturday Night Live. Perhaps even more fittingly, the transition from the established stars to newcomers such as Clark officially started the same day. Another trailblazing performer, Candace Parker, announced her retirement. But like Parker, Clark enters this season with one primary goal, winning games. I think no matter what happens, there's going to be expectations and pressure on my shoulders, and pressure on this team to be really good. That's how you want it, Clark said. We wouldn't want anything else. We want people showing up to our games, people expecting us to win a lot of basketball games this year, and I'm expecting myself to play really well. I don't think it's anything that's ever been different for me. That kind of talk certainly is new to the Fever. Indiana hasn't reached the playoffs since 2016, hasn't posted a winning season since 2015, and has been mostly irrelevant nationally since Hall of Famer Tamika Catchings' retirement. Over the past five seasons, the Fever won 28 games. Iowa, meanwhile, went 65-12 and with two national runner-up finishes in Clark's final two college seasons. But the pairing of Clark and Aliyah Boston, the WNBA's unanimous Rookie of the Year, last season has turned Indiana into one of the league's hottest tickets. Several opponents already have moved games to larger arenas, and Boston is eager to see how quickly Indiana's new lineup will mesh. Clark arrived in town early this past week and has been turning heads with her workouts ever since. I think Caitlin has a different eye for the game. You're able to see how well she passes the ball and how well she shoots it, Boston said. And you are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we're going to turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger, and we're going to see what the first story is. Front page. Monday, April 29, 2024, two charged after body found in rural Webster County. It's written by Deanna Meyer, and it reads, Two Fort Dodge men have been arrested after a man was found dead of an apparent gunshot wound Friday in a rural Webster County ditch. The body was identified as that of Dennis R. Jones, 55, of Fort Dodge. Alec R. Jones, 26, of Fort Dodge, is charged with first-degree murder, and Nathan T. Jones, 21, of Fort Dodge, is charged with aiding and abetting murder in the first degree in connection with his death. The two are now in custody in the Webster County Jail. Dennis Jones's body was found after a mail carrier on his route called the Webster County Telecommunications Center around 12:18 p.m. Friday, saying that he might have found a body. Consequently, Dennis Jones's body was found in a ditch in the 2100 mile of 280th Street, according to a media release from the Fort Dodge Police Department. The location is near where 280th Street intersects with U.S. Highway 169 south of Fort Dodge. An investigation led officials to believe Dennis Jones had not been shot where he was found. A subsequent search warrant was executed at 1440 2nd Avenue South in Fort Dodge, according to the Webster County Assessor's Office. That property is owned by Dennis R. Jones Jr. and Shannon C. Jones. The two arrests followed that search. Incident remains under investigation. Anyone with information related to this case is encouraged to contact the Fort Dodge Police by calling the Webster County Law Enforcement Center at 515-573-2323. Anonymous tips can be submitted to Webster County Crime Shoppers by calling 515-573-1444. Going online at wccrimestoppers.com or by texting LEC and the tip to 274-637. The Fort Dodge Police Department was assisted by the Webster County Sheriff's Office, Fort Dodge Fire Department, Webster County Attorney's Office, Iowa Department of Natural Resources, Webster County Medical Examiner, the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, and Special Emergency Response Team. Legislatures urge voters to give AEA changes a chance. This is written by Lori Berglund. Give it a chance. That was often the message from legislators as they took repeated questions on changes to the state's area education agency system during Saturday's Eggs and Issues Forum at Iowa Central Community College, sponsored by the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance. Despite several questions on the AEA from those in attendance, State Representative Mike Sexton, a Republican of Rockwell City, said he really isn't getting any questions on the issue when he sees voters while out and about in daily life. "Not really in my district. I don't get a lot of questions on it," Sexton said in response to a follow-up question following the forum. Sexton said he hopes that people will give the changes a chance to work. "What I've been telling folks is, give it a year, see what happens, let the dust settle. Typically, in my legislative experience, you have this big, huge uproar, and then when people actually see what the bill does, nobody talks about it anymore," Sexton said. To audience questions that frame the changes as dismantling the AEAs, legislators replied, "We did not dismantle the AEA." Joining Sexton at Saturday's forum were Representative Ann Meyer, Republican Fort Dodge, Senator Tim Crayenbrink, Republican Fort Dodge. Oversight for the AEA was returned to the Department of Education, Meyer said, describing the most important change he saw in the bill. Crayenbrink was quick to agree with that assessment. "When the AEA was created, the Department of Education was in charge of oversight. That kind of morphed into something else over the years," he said. "We're going back to the way it was created." And, end quote. Increases to teacher salaries were also a topic on Saturday, and legislators sought to emphasize that the money to improve teacher pay is separate from regular school funding. The question asked how schools will be able to afford to pay teachers more. This is a separate pile of money from what we use to fund schools, Meyer said. Krayenbrink said he was baffled by a suggestion that schools would be underfunded. By contrast, the increase in teacher pay that will eventually take it to $50,000 annually for new teachers will put pressure on schools to perform. It's important that we see results from the pay increase, Krayenbrink said. After years of work on the issue, the legislature did approve a flat income tax rate of 3.8%. There was concern that the move may benefit relatively few people, but legislators were not convinced of that viewpoint. Krayenbrink had a suggestion for those concerned that it would not generate enough income. Just send in whatever you are paying now, he said. If people want to pay more, they are free to do so. Just note it on the tax return. For Krayenbrink, it was his hope that the state would stay at the 3.8% rate for the foreseeable future. The rate is a significant decrease from the current top rate of 5.7%. Concerns were also raised about the long-term impact on sales taxes. While the flat income tax rate would require more effort to change, the sales tax would be far less complicated. My concerns with the bill is that it does not address sales tax as part of it, Sexton said. While a two-thirds majority will be needed to increase the flat income tax, only a simple majority will be needed to increase the sales tax, according to Sexton. The relative ease to increase sales taxes over income tax could lead to more dependence on sales tax income as a revenue source in the future. One audience member asked about a reported decline in maternal health rates coinciding with abortion restrictions signed into law in recent years. Meyer was quick to take note that it would be impossible to link the new laws with any change in maternal health. The abortion laws have not changed in Iowa, Meyer said. Every law that we pass goes directly to the courts. None of the pro-life measures signed by Reynolds and approved by the legislature have been allowed to go into effect yet, according to legislators at Saturday's forum. By contrast, Meyer pointed to legislation that was approved in this session to improve maternal health. We extended postpartum care for Medicaid recipients from 2 months to 12 months, Meyer said. She noted that the extended coverage will give health care providers more time to catch potential problems for new moms, which will in turn benefit the babies in their care. In response to the question linking new laws with maternal health, Krayenbrink said, "This is one of those situations that bothers me, to begin a question with a false statement, given that those laws are not in place." Maternal health, he added, is actually a bipartisan concern. We need to find out why we have the maternal death rates we do, but no one, Republican or Democrat, wants a child to pass away, he said. Now, speed cameras. Legislators were asked to comment and explain changes approved for speed cameras in Iowa. The changes, according to Meyer, will really only affect cameras on state highways. Jurisdictions that place speed cameras on primary roads or state highways will have to show verification that the cameras are necessary to reduce speed and or improve accident safety rates. The new changes approved by the legislature do not affect cameras placed on city streets, so the cameras in Fort Dodge, which are used to fund police officers, will not be impacted. In adjacent Hamilton County, the city of Webster City recently placed speed cameras on Iowa Highway 17 and U.S. Highway 20, both highways that will fall under the regulations. Meyer also noted that communities with populations under 8,000 would not be allowed to place speed cameras. And Convention of the States, the next topic. A growing number of states are calling for a convention of the states, and more support for that effort is being seen in Iowa. Sexton was the first to weigh in on this issue and noted that he was long reluctant to support a call for a convention of the states. However, Growing budget deficits by Congress have swayed his support in favor of the proposal. "I voted for it," Sexton said. "Those of us who voted for it already know that Washington is Crayonbrook. Those of us who voted for it already know that Washington is Crayonbrook is another supporter of the issue, of the measure. I'm for it, but I've never voted on it," he said. Crayonbrook acknowledged that the primary concern against the convention of the states is that it could turn into a runaway convention that would drift from a strong focus on balancing the budget to far-reaching social issues that have not been part of the original intent. However, he said the way a convention would work is that a sole no vote would kill any measure. "It only takes one person to say no," he said. Here's an article, page 5 of The Messenger, entitled "Iowa is Wetter Than It's Been in Nearly a Year," written by Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. "Another wet week helped lift parts of Iowa from drought, and the remaining dry conditions are predicted to continue to ease into the summer. More than an inch and a half of rain fell on average across the state last week, according to a recent U.S. Department of Agriculture report. That was about 74% more than is normally expected. The result was an 8% decrease in the area of the state that is suffering from drought, according to a U.S. Drought Monitor report on Thursday. The most noticeable gain was in southwest Iowa in parts or all of 9 counties. Drought also retreated in southeast, northeast, and north-central parts of the state. About 58% of Iowa has some measure of drought, down from a recent high of about 97% in September, but it's still drier than it was a year ago, when about 30% of the state had drought. A broad area of eastern Iowa that had extreme drought, the second to worst classification, and occupied more than a third of the state early this year, has dwindled," the Drought Monitor reported. "Less than 3% of the state is now classified that way. The dryness is expected to improve in the coming months. According to the Federal Climate Prediction Center, drought in the southwest quadrant of Iowa might be almost entirely gone. About 13% of the state's corn crop and 8% of its soybeans had been planted as of Sunday," the USDA said. "Nearly two-thirds of the state's topsoil had adequate or surplus soil moisture for growing crops, along with about 45% of its deeper soil. That was a marked improvement from a week ago, but still trailed soil moisture a year ago." I'm going to read this one obituary we have in today's paper before I go to the opinion section. And it's for Rose Lynn of Dayton, 90 years old, of Dayton and formerly of Lehigh, Iowa, passed away early Saturday morning, April 27, at Grandview Health Care Center in Dayton. A come-and-go celebration of life for Rose will be held from 1 p.m. until 3 p.m. on Saturday, May 4, at Carson Stapp Funeral Home in Dayton. Burial will follow at 3:30 p.m. at McGuire Bend Cemetery, rural Dayton. Pastor Kay Christie will officiate. For online obituaries and condolences, you can visit carsonsstapp.com. Here's a local column on the opinion section today. It's called "Keeping Kids Safe from Harm. Grassley, Foster Children Want to Grow Up in a Safe, Permanent, Loving Home," is the headline. Question asked of him on this opinion article. Editorial: "How are you working," not an editorial, opinion, "how are you working to help attack, how are you helping to work, I'll try it again, I'm sorry. How are you working to help at-risk kids grow up in safe homes," is the question. Grassley's answer, Senator Grassley: "Society has a moral imperative to protect the next generation from harm. Every child deserves to grow up in a safe, loving home to reach their full potential. As a father of 5 and grandfather of 9, I understand the responsibilities of parenthood are demanding. Raising kids is an around-the-clock job filled with sleepless nights when they're infants, followed by losing sleep when they're teenagers, gaining more independence from mom and dad. Nurturing and nourishing their minds and bellies while managing the demands of a job and household are challenging for certain. Family is the cornerstone of civil society, and keeping this institution strong strengthens America. At the policymaking table in Washington, D.C., I roll up my sleeves to strengthen adoption, child welfare, and juvenile justice laws that protect at-risk youth and also lead efforts to keep families intact. A few years ago, I advanced passage of the Prevention-Focused Family First Prevention Services Act that took effect in October of 2019. It provides support to states to expand substance abuse and parenting skills programs, as well as mental health services for families to help prevent the need to remove children from the home in the first place. When I co-founded the bipartisan Senate Caucus on Foster Youth in 2009, I made it my mission to ensure young people placed in foster care have a voice at the table. My work to improve outcomes for kids and teenagers who have been removed from their homes due to neglect or abuse is informed by the feedback I get from them. The most empathetic, emphatic plea I hear from these young people is the desire to grow up in a safe, permanent, loving home. So I work to help make sure federal policies aren't creating obstacles for reunification or adoption. One of the challenges confronting child welfare advocates across the country is the shortage of qualified foster families. In turn, that means lack of placement options in family-based settings for kids awaiting adoption or reunification with their parents. This Congress, I introduced a bipartisan, bicameral legislation called the Recruiting Families Using Data Act to improve recruitment, retention, and support for foster parents. Our bill would bring vital voices to the table, from birth, adopting, and foster parents to kinship and community-based providers, as well as youth who have experienced in foster care and adoption, to help improve outreach in local communities, to identify and screen potential foster families, and provide better supports for existing foster families. It would require state agencies to gather data to inform policymakers about licensing, training, and reasons why foster families decide to stop taking placements, for example. I'll continue pushing for Senate passage this year. Congress must do its part to help at-risk kids have a safe place to call home. And the other question on this article is, what are your recent efforts to prevent child exploitation and protect survivors? And Senator Grassley's answer. First of all, I encourage every parent to be vigilant for human trafficking and online exploitation of their kids. It happens right under our noses, including in Iowa. As former chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I've led efforts to tackle these heinous crimes that trade on commercial exploitation of people, including children, through forced labor and sexual slavery, and to raise awareness about cybercrimes known as financial sextortion. I helped steer the Bipartisan Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act through Congress that renewed vital programs to prevent human trafficking, promote justice for survivors, and provide services to victims of these crimes. I also worked with Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire to secure passage of the Survivor's Bill of Rights in the States Act that will improve support for rape survivors, including the right to receive a medical forensic kit without charge, no matter which state they live in, and to be informed in writing about its collection and preservation. Most recently, my bipartisan bill will send with Senator John Ossoff of Georgia sharpens the existing federal sex tourism prevention law in the aftermath of the sexual abuse scandal involving hundreds of young athletes by convicted former doctor of USA Gymnastics Larry Nassar. All three of these bills have been signed into law. I'm glad the U.S. Department of Justice reached a settlement with the survivors of Larry Nassar's abuse and commend them for their courage to speak up and pursue justice, including their public testimony at a congressional hearing I convened in 2021. I'll continue my robust oversight of the FBI to help ensure its failures to protect these young women doesn't happen again. Time for a couple sports stories here. This one, the headline is Lynx Stay Perfect with Win Over Humboldt by Chris Johnson. It says it may be late April, but Friday's regular season matchup for Webster City had a postseason feel. The fourth-ranked Lynx, 9-0 overall, turned in a solid performance to turn back Humboldt, North Central Conference foe Humboldt, 2-1. The victory over the Wildcats, 7-1, was the first for Webster City 2019. Since 2019, Humboldt had won for the last six matches, 5 by a single goal. It's been a while, said Webster City head coach Craig Signoren. 2019 was the last victory we've taken at Humboldt, so this one is special, he said. Junior Eddie Fuentes scored the first goal on an assist from Israel Torres. We had an incredible counter off their corner. Playing Eddie, though, Signorin said. They left one man back, and Eddie went by him to finish it off. Israel played David at the top of the box and had a great strike on the goal, second. The goal boxes were messy, and it got enough to put us up 2-0. Humboldt's lone goal came from Christian Ramirez, his 17th of the season. Nolan Gustafson took a free kick that rebounded off their keeper, and Ramirez put it away. It was a good competitive game. I think I can speak for all the coaches. We're very proud of everything this team is doing to work hard and improve, said Humboldt head coach Joe Hadar. Even before the game, it had been a good day just from some things we have hopefully improved in our preparations. We get so much support, and I know the guys feed off that. Humboldt has won 6 of the last 8 in the series. I guess the positive is we know we can compare. We can compete with the top team in our conference, Hadar said. We've got 2 home games this week, then off to Nevada next Saturday, where we know we'll play small school power Iowa City Regina and either Gilbert or Perry. The team is excited for the May run in, and we get to play Webster City again. From now until then, we have to make sure that game matters for the conference title, he said. Signorin was pleased with his team's efforts. Edwin Nolasco Ramos made 2 great saves early, and our back line was stellar, Signorin said. They didn't give them anything easy. I was so proud of how well they played. I can't praise Aiden Ray, Abasi Ramirez, Junior, J.R., and Walfrey Lopez enough. Webster City leads the series in the last 25 matches, 15-8-1. Here's some stories from the area sports roundup. Triton baseball team earned sweep. The 7th-ranked Iowa Central baseball team picked up 2 wins over Southeastern on Saturday. The Tritons, 39-10 overall, won the opener 15-11 and closed with a 13-8 victory. In the first contest, the Tritons built a 13-0 lead through the top of the 5th. After 6 innings, Southeastern cut the lead to 14-11. And moving on, Tritons lose twice. In Boone, the Iowa Central softball team dropped a twin bill to DMAC on Saturday. The Bears won both contests 4-3 over the Tritons 33-19. In the 33-19. In the opener, Gabriella Tabor had 2 RBIs, while Alexis Hansen also drove in a run. DMAC pitcher Courtney Donahue, 20-3, pitched a 5-hitter while striking out 13 Tritons. In the nightcap, the Tritons pounded out 8 hits. Tabor had 2 hits and a home run. Kennedy Palmer and Carly Ryan also drove in runs. Ryan and Kaylee Carey both had doubles. And St. Edmund Alumni and Friends Tourney, the St. Edmund Alumni and Friends Basketball Tournament, will be Saturday, May 4, beginning at 8 a.m. Games will be 10-minute halves at the high school gym. Entry fee is $25 per player. Each group must have at least 5 players signed up by April 28, or other players will be added to their team. This tournament is not limited to St. Edmund alumni. For more information, please contact Neil Flattery at 515-570-7894 or email Neil, N-E-I-L, at trevinocpas.com. That is TREVINOCPAS.com. And finally, the 48th annual Magweed Fishing Tournament will be Saturday, May 4 at Triggs Bay Resort in Arnold's Park. The competition begins at 12:01 a.m. on Saturday with weigh-ins from 4 to 6 p.m. that evening. Iowa DNR rules and regulations will be followed. There is no registration or fees. Prizes will be rewarded in youth and adult divisions for largest walleye, largest northern pike, largest bass, small or large, and biggest panfish for youth, perch, bluegill, crappie, sunfish, and yellow bass. Every youth fish weighed in is eligible for a prize. The grand prize in the youth division is a bike. The event is sponsored by the MagWed, M-A-G-W-E-D Foundation. For more information, please contact Jared Denklaw by email at magwed@outlook.com. And there is also a MagWed Facebook page. And here's what's on the TV. If you're interested in college softball, Mississippi State is at Missouri, 6 p.m., SECN. Major League Baseball, Minnesota is playing Chicago White Sox, 6:30 p.m., FS1. L.A. Dodgers are at Arizona, 8:30 p.m. on MLBN. NBA playoffs, Oklahoma City at New Orleans, 8:30 p.m., TBA. Boston at Miami, 6:30 p.m., TNT. L.A. Lakers at Denver, 9 p.m., TNT. And the NHL playoffs, you'll find Tampa Bay at Florida, 6 p.m., ESPN. You'll find Dallas at Vegas, 8:30 p.m. on ESPN. This brings us to the end of today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger, April 29, 2024. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. I want to thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. I hope you have a good day.